Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Bramling.
I'm Jenny Brentes.
I'm Connor Orr.
Week 11 Sunday, we had Chiefs-Cowboys as the big headliner here, and I don't know, I think maybe some people were expecting a shootout here, maybe a 50-45 type of affair, but instead we get 19-9, which, if you're a Chiefs fan, seems like that's just fine at this point.
Yeah, I mean, at this, you know, going into this, if you would have added all this together, right, Dak Prescott plus Steve Spagnuolo plus primetime game, you know, we were looking at something resembling a shootout, but instead, it was a great defensive performance from Kansas City. I thought, like, their ability to pick up stuff on, like, very thin man-to-man coverage was great, and albeit you don't have CeeDee Lamb and Amari Cooper to deal with, so you can kind of run that risk. And they're up front, like, you know, the twisting, the stunting that they were able to pull on a very good offensive line and bother Dak Prescott was great. So not the game that we expected, but, you know, a nice win for the Chiefs.
Yeah, the Chiefs defense has really gotten together in the last 4 weeks or so. I think they're averaging less than 12 points per game during that stretch, which is a marked improvement from where they were early in the year. And a big reason for that is Chris Jones. Moving him inside has proved to be incredibly helpful. I mean, that's where he thrives. That's where he's been at his best. I was not super optimistic about the impact that Melvin Ingram would have in the Chiefs defense, but I think his addition allowed them to move Chris Jones inside, which has been incredibly impactful. You know, we saw him get the tip at the end of the game. Jones did for the game clinching interception. He had multiple sacks during the game. So it does seem like they've really turned a corner on the defense. And I will say that that's not unusual with Steve Spagnuolo units. I've seen them for a long time. I still remember the Super Bowl season with the Giants in 2007, and they started 0-2 and the defense was like a sieve. And then they just really got it together. So I think because the scheme can be somewhat complicated, I think a lot of times it does take a while for the timing to get together and for the players to get on the same page with some of the calls. And we've seen that a little bit, but I think the biggest impact is putting Chris Jones where he's most comfortable.
Yeah, and it's a good point with the defense. I mean, the Chiefs Super Bowl season, they were 6-4 at this point, and it was really the defense improving that turned things around for that Kansas City team that year. I also want to point out Melvin Ingram is just really weird for wearing number 24 as an edge rusher. I've gotten past most of these, but 24 on like a 250-pound edge rusher, just I don't know. Who are you? That's my question to Melvin Ingram.
Well, two points in response. One, I still think Matthew Judon is the weirdest. Number 9 as a pass rusher is never going to make sense to me. And the second point, Gary, how dare you make a recent reference? You know that we only do references that are like more than 10 years ago on New York-based teams. So The Chiefs' recent Super Bowl is really less relevant in this podcast than the 2007 Giants. I just wanted to clear that point up.
Here's how the 2012 Jets relate to what's going on right now in Dallas. Look, I still think the Cowboys are really good. I would put them right up there with any team in the NFC. I don't know what you draw from this game as a takeaway for them. They went in without Amari Cooper. They lost CeeDee Lamb late in the first half. Ezekiel Elliott tweaked his ankle. And it was just sort of an off day anyway. So, you know, maybe they're not the team that just beat Atlanta 48-0 or whatever the final was there. But, you know, I still feel fine about this team. And I actually feel pretty good about the fact that their defense did hang around in this one. I mean, this was basically a two-possession game throughout. The Chiefs got an early turnover, kicked a field goal. This was a 9-0 game very early on, and it never really, you know, the Cowboys did get a field goal, but like the Chiefs' defense was never on the field defending anything less than a two-possession game, which just made it kind of, I don't know, it just was very even throughout the entire flow of this game.
And in sticking with Gary's allegiance to the law of averages, the Chiefs do seem to be getting all of the fluky turnovers out of the way. That is the one thing that has not really abated. We saw another fluky turnover, a pass that was a little bit behind Travis Kelce, but then bounces off his hands and turns into an interception. So, you know, under Gary's theory, right, we're just getting them all out of the way before maybe, I don't know, week 14, and then the Chiefs will just not have to worry about them the rest of the season, right? Is that how it works?
I don't know if it's out of the way. It's lulling everyone into a false sense of confidence that you're going to be able to take the ball away from this offense. I think that's where it falls.
You know, they say that one person can't make a difference in the world, but Gary has created an entire podcast about sample size now. And that is like a really, that's a really amazing thing. But I think what really is the big bummer here is that there are just like, there's like a segment of the football media Twitterati here that, you know, just stayed silent throughout the beginning of the season and didn't really weigh in on the Chiefs' struggle and is now just being like, yeah, the reason I did that is because we all knew that they were going to be awesome again. And that's been annoying for me because I like to have very outsized opinions about no sample size. And so, you know, I kind of live and die by that. And so this has not been an enjoyable experience for me, the fact that this good team is now playing fine, you know?
Steelers, Chargers.
So Sunday Night Football was a wild one here. Shorthanded Steelers team ends up falling 41-37 to the Chargers out in L.A. And we're going to talk about the Ravens a little bit later and their kind of method of winning games. But the Steelers are a little bit similar, and this one really felt like in the fourth quarter it was going to be one of those games where the Steelers kind of had no right winning, but they just end up winning. They get a blocked punt, they get a tipped interception. That's just what the Steelers do.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive that despite trailing by 17 points at one point in the game, they quickly made it interesting through a few of those plays that you described, Gary. The defense was out a lot of star players. Ben Roethlisberger was coming off of COVID, but they found ways to create when they could. That on the blocked punt, that was three rushers coming forward, one of whom hit the ball. They had the Cam Hayward sort of headbutt of a batted pass. I didn't realize until the replay that it actually went off of his helmet, which turned into an interception. So it was, they needed like a flurry of activity in order to get back in the game, and they were able to summon that, which was pretty impressive. All that being said, though, it ended up being like a very unsatisfying ending because they had done so much to get back in the game, and then at one point it looked like they were going to win the game, and they get the ball back after the Chargers go for it on fourth down and can't convert. So the Steelers get the ball back, but can't make a first down, kick the field goal, and then there's a busted coverage, and the Chargers score the game-winning touchdown.
Really interesting thing about that busted coverage, right? So that was Norwood, right, who's filling in for Minkah Fitzpatrick, and I would venture to say that if Minkah Fitzpatrick is in on that play, he probably picks that off, right? Because if you look at how the route developed, Justin Herbert throws it as soon as it's clear that the safety is not coming down to compensate for the cornerback passing him off. But what's interesting is I think the other thing that Minkah Fitzpatrick knows is Mike Williams runs more go routes than any receiver in the NFL. Actually, since 2020, has run 30 more go routes than any receiver in the NFL. So what do you think he's doing in that situation? Largely. I mean, you know, they didn't deviate from the plan. You kind of figured what was going on there. And for me, you know, I know the Steelers were playing down a couple guys and, you know, certainly your most vital players. But like, it's interesting that, you know, that's the kind of situation you sort of found yourself in. You're putting a lot on a safety who's filling in for arguably the headiest defensive player in the NFL in the secondary. I don't know. It's just a kind of an interesting smattering of events there.
Yeah, and obviously, look, no T.J. Watt. That's a huge impact player to be missing. But Fitzpatrick is a guy who gets him organized on the back end, and that is a play where, you know, if he doesn't intercept it, it is probably just a throw that's not available, or at least it's a it's a contested type of play instead of that. But, you know, just the Steelers team, the way they win games, they do not want to have to score 27 points in the fourth quarter in order to be in a game. stylistically, this is not how they want to play. This is not a game they probably should have won when it's all said and done, but the opportunity was there.
Yeah, it is really hard to imagine that that play would have gone the same way with Minka Fitzpatrick in the lineup. But that being said, the fact that they were able to muster the performance that they did until the very end, that they had a chance to win this game. I mean, do you take something from that? It certainly was better than a week earlier where you have a very unsatisfying tie. Okay, a week later, your quarterback's coming off COVID, like I said. You're missing three of your top defenders. Is this a galvanizing almost win, or is it such a disappointing loss because you almost had it that it ends up kind of undercutting morale? It's hard to say, and I guess that's up to Mike Tomlin's messaging in part.
Yeah, I just want to point out real quick, I think the kneel downs brought the Chargers back under 8 yards per play in this game. I mean, you just look at the number, and this is, 533 yards of offense for the Chargers, 300 for the Steelers. I mean, it was a fairly lopsided game outside of those two really game-altering plays that they got.
Yeah, I mean, and to Jenny's point, like, I loved, like, the juxtaposition between, like, there are all these stoic shots of Cam Hayward after the batted down pass, and it was just like, you know, those slow motion, like, warrior poses where he's just like, like the steely guy poses, but like, really, the Justin Herbert just fired the ball off his head. Like, there really wasn't, like, you know, and you jumped a little bit, like, and I'm not discounting the fact that, like, you're an amazing player, you know, and he's an incredible player, and his role on that fourth down stop later on was critical, and you know, he's a great player, but in that very moment the ball just got rocked off your helmet, and so, you know, I thought that was kind of a funny thing.
One thing I did wonder about, speaking of the team being shorthanded, is after they make the fourth down stop of the Chargers, get the ball back in Chargers territory with a couple minutes to go, the game tied, if they had Najee Harris in that at that situation, would they have been able to get the first down? Harris was in the locker room getting evaluated for concussion, which is where he should have been. Glad that they took that evaluation seriously. But I just couldn't help but wonder. Harris is then later cleared to return to the game. And I remember thinking when they were lining up on the third down, they originally didn't have a back in, and they took a timeout, and they came out with a back that wasn't Harris. And I just was thinking to myself, I wonder how much of a difference Harris would have made in that situation.
Yeah, that was three and out there, and he was back out there for the next play that they ran after that field goal, which was after the Mike Williams touchdown. But this was this was entertaining. This one looked like it might get ugly, and it ended up being really interesting. So I guess we should be thankful for that.
Packers Vikings.
So I am going to go rogue here for a second and officially proclaim this the game of the day. The Vikings 34-31 victory over the Packers, probably just because we had a lot of points and a back-and-forth game, and that made things much more interesting than most of these other games.
And yet another Vikings game that came down to the final minutes. I will note that Gary Gramling was the only MMQB staffer to pick the Vikings, so he saw this coming. Maybe it was because of the spreadsheet. Maybe he just had confidence that they were better than the record indicated, which is true. They are better than the record indicated. They had a lot of crazy finishes, but this was a really entertaining game in a slate of games that was not super entertaining on the whole.
For reasons that I cannot disclose on this podcast, I have no control over my weekly picks, so I did not pick the Packers. But on last week's podcast, I did say that the Vikings were going to be the surprise team of the second half. This was a big showing by the Vikings in a big spot. God bless Mike Zimmer for, when a game comes down to the line, still trusting a field goal kicker. Like, you know, this is, again, I mean, this was a situation that if a field goal kicker had missed this particular kick to win the game, I would have absolutely believed, if I was Mike Zimmer, that something was wholly and irreversibly cursed with my team. But yeah, this was a big win for Minnesota. I think they increased their playoff odds quite a bit, and I think that they just get closer to putting a grab on that seventh seed.
And I don't want to go nuts here. This wasn't like a Kirk Cousins. Remember when Rich Gannon was playing for Gruden back in the early 2000s? They'd have these games where it was like 71 pass attempts. This was not that for Kirk Cousins, but it was a game in which they clearly leaned on the passing game a little bit more, and it made plenty of sense because, you know, the Packers have all these injuries in the secondary and the cornerback and core, and they could not cover Justin Jefferson and Adam Thielen in this game, who end up combining for just an obscene, I think it was 16 for 251 and 3 touchdowns on 20 targets to the two of them. So that was nice to see, rather than just saying, all right, well, let's make sure we get our running backs their 35 combined carries and try and wait it out this way. Because, look, that's the Packers can be got right now as far as this pass defense goes. No Jaire Alexander, no Za'Darius Smith, had Rashawn Gary miss this game. So they're susceptible there. And the Vikings took advantage of what is very clearly an edge they have in this matchup.
You know what's pretty amazing is that the Vikings had a great duo of receivers, Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs. Diggs wanted out. They traded him to Buffalo. And then in that year's draft, they're like, all right, we're just going to get another receiver to plug into that position, the duo with Adam Thielen. Receiver is a very difficult position to draft. We see some of the best personnel departments routinely get it wrong. I mean, the Ravens really struggle with the receiver draft, and they are one of the best drafting teams in the NFL, right? But the Vikings just were like, yeah, we're going to use a pick in this year's draft to replace Diggs. And then they just did it. And Justin Jefferson is amazing. Like, I just wanted to take a second to acknowledge how seamlessly that worked out for them.
The receiver play in this game was absolutely phenomenal. And obviously you have Davante Adams on one side, but Jenny, to your point, I mean, Justin Jefferson should have had another touchdown. You know, he was like a, you know, whatever, a beard hair away from another touchdown. And, you know, it was just an incredible thing to watch him just slice open a defense. And then on the other side, the technical aspects of Adam Thielen's game, you know, some of the sideline catches that he made today, there was one on that final, I think it was the final game-winning drive that easily should have been intercepted, and somehow he like catches the ball in front of the defender and then like swerves his way underneath it and still picks up yards after the catch. And it was just like an absolute clinic on receiver play.
It was. And look, if you're the Packers right now, this is what your defense probably should look like. We've kind of marveled at how much they've overachieved with all these injuries, but this kind of is what it should look like when you have this many injuries, this many really legitimately star, like all pro caliber guys on that side of the ball. The one good takeaway from the Packers is Aaron Rodgers looked like vintage Aaron Rodgers in this one. And I, Connor, I hope you enjoyed that foot pop on the touchdown pass to it was Josiah DeGuara was the one who caught it, but it was that rolling left, and looks biomechanically impossible for him to put the ball with any zip into the spot where he put it. But there you go. You have to go one back in your feed to find out what went on there.
Yeah. And it was weird too, because he looked so, it was almost a continuation of the weeks prior that we'd seen. And I'm not here to say that like you have to throw three or four touchdowns in a game to be able to have like a vintage Aaron Rodgers performance. You can still have Aaron Rodgers performances and not perform that way. But he looked so kind of distant and out of it for such a large portion of this game. And then the second half comes in and you just get a different player. And, you know, that one touchdown was a great example, but his mobility, like everything just seemed to perk up and improve in the second half. And I don't know if that was wide receivers creating more space for themselves, getting open, but in the first half, those attempted sort of biomechanically impossible throws almost all ended in throwaways or sacks or, you know, hits or something like that. So it was really amazing to see that development after half. It must have been the extra rest that Aaron Rodgers gave himself watching the end of that first half in the tunnel.
But it was impressive to see a performance that good, given that he's dealing with this toe injury. His practice reps were limited. I mean, the reports before the game, some of the NFL insiders were like, well, Rodgers' reps are limited and that could really impact his performance in the game. And, you know, it was sort of a strange thing to put out there, right? Like, was it a preemptive, like, hey, if things don't go well, this is why. But you couldn't really notice, although Rodgers said he got stepped on early in the game, which sort of re-aggravated some of the things he was feeling. And a toe injury is not great. I mean, we saw Patrick Mahomes had a toe injury in last year's Super Bowl. It's hard for a quarterback to have a toe injury, especially a quarterback that relies on his mobility to the degree that Rodgers does. So the fact that he had this kind of performance with a toe injury was impressive. Now, will the toe worsen? Will it, you know, how long will it take to heal? Those are all open questions at this point.
Can you immunize a toe?
I wasn't going to do that. I was going to make a joke. about with all the toe reports this morning. I really thought Aaron Rodgers was going to like roll out there and like, I don't know, just a comfortable chair and like an ottoman and like play the game in that way. Because everyone was just tweeting about a toe.
Exactly. It was like a flood of toe tweets. Like it was setting up for a horrible performance.
Yes, it really was. And it was just like, oh, wait a second. There's nothing wrong here. I had already picked the Vikings at that point, but yeah. I don't know. His toe's fine. We'll see what happens going forward, but so far, so good.
Ravens, Bears.
All right, so this is where we start to get weird on this show. Weirder than Aaron Rodgers' toe jokes. So this was the Ravens going to Chicago, winning 16-13. Lamar Jackson was out with a non-COVID illness, and you watch these games and you figure out how teams win and you just kind of say like, oh, yeah, you sort of try to build that narrative in your head. Like, okay, this is how they're going to do it. This is how they want to do it. When the Ravens win these games, I don't know. You just shrug your shoulders and it's like, that was kind of impossible. There's no way they planned it that way, but they just consistently do it and they get it done. And I think maybe that's the takeaway here. The Ravens will just figure it out no matter what you throw at them in the end.
I think that's right, Gary. And I do think that is a strength of the Ravens teams. And I think John Harbaugh as a coach allows for and encourages that, right? Like he's a special teams coach. So he thinks about things differently and he looks for edges in different places, or he knows that you can win a game in different ways. Sort of a nebulous thing to say, but I feel like the way in which he leads the team deserves a lot of praise for wins like this, which don't seem obvious. And for much of this game seemed like it wasn't going to happen, but they find a way to pull it out. I mean, Tyler Huntley making that play on 3rd and 13, I think it was, to Sammy Watkins, and they had a penalty. Didn't look like he was going to be able to convert the 3rd and long, certainly given the way the offense had played for the rest of the game. And then he does, and they score the go ahead touchdown. He said after the game that he learned he was going to start by getting a text message from Lamar Jackson on the way to the bus. So I think all in all, it was a pretty impressive performance by the team to come out with a win under those conditions and now be atop the AFC standings.
Just a quick question for Gary. Was this like, because Gary organizes the show, was this like CBS? Did you feel locked into putting this game into the B block? Or was this like, what was the thought process here?
It felt like the B block because I don't want to spoil what's coming up, but kind of grouped the AFC South upsets together. And then you kind of get the, I tried to pair my two favorite sort of underdog quarterbacks together after that. And then I thought that we could sort of bust on the Seahawks a little bit later and not put them in the lightning round, but put them lightning round adjacent, which might be just as insulting as putting them in the lightning round.
I would agree. If I was Pete Carroll, I'd definitely feel the same way. And that there'll be some good stuff to get to there. But I think if you're the Bears, there's no excuse for this, right? I mean, if Lamar Jackson's not there and you have a quarterback in Andy Dalton that, yes, Justin Fields got hurt there, but is theoretically just as suited for, if not maybe slightly better for, suited for running your offense right now, there's a 0% excuse rate for a loss like this. Like, yes, Baltimore's defense, is good theoretically on paper, not statistically coming into this game, but better than statistics have shown. And they're starting a quarterback that, like Jenny said, found out about this, you know, on the bus ride to the game, hadn't taken any reps. I mean, there's just no reason for you to lose this game, and, you know, is really sort of a pretty damning indictment of what is left of the Matt Nagy era here.
By the way, to correct myself, the Titans are still atop the AFC standings, but the Ravens are atop the AFC North. So I did want to clean that up. However, it does feel like the Ravens may be the best team in the AFC. Although, listen, this changes week to week. And I guess one positive for Tyler Huntley is that because of the illness and because Lamar Jackson has been sick other times this season and has dealt with other injuries, he has had the ability to take some practice reps. And so maybe was a little bit more prepared than just like a last second being thrown out there. But as we know, it's always different to play a whole game as the starter. And no matter how many reps you get in practice, even though you are better positioned if you get first team reps, it's still a completely different situation once you have to play a whole game.
Yeah, they clearly had some things. I mean, his completions in the first half were all kind of like highly schemed plays, which is fine. I mean, that's how you're going to do it here. But look, they scored one touchdown in this game, and it came on a five-play, 72-yard drive over a minute 19 to win it with 22 seconds left. So, you know, that Sammy Watkins throw was huge. I do want to, number one, point out, look, Khalil Mack or no Khalil Mack, this Bears team's identity is its defense. They have now, in back-to-back games, allowed a late scoring drive to a bad offense to lose games. And yes, you know, the offense is going out there and lighting the world on fire. These are not like 55-53 losses here, but you got to get off the field. You got to get off the field against Tyler Huntley. Like, there's no real way to slice it other than that. The other thing I just want to mention real quick, Andy Dalton was not, you know, particularly good in his play in relief. He had that one long catch and run touchdown to Darnell Mooney that got the Bears on the board and sort of got things going here. But the second one, the one to Marquise Goodwin, I know he's not gonna, I don't know, like lay down and die at this point, but for Dalton to basically stare down a zero blitz and know he's just gonna get blasted and know that he's going to just have to chuck up this moon ball to Marquise Goodwin, who's, you know, it's a double move on the play, so you got to put a ton of air under it. But mostly, you just know you're going to get blasted on that play. And for Dalton to stand in and take that hit and make the throw, that's, I don't know, send him a Mylar balloon or something. That was a good play.
You referenced the Mylar balloon in your column this morning, too,
yes.
Gary. I'm not a bright person. What is a Mylar balloon?
It's like the shiny metal-y balloon that's terrible for the environment. And my house is littered with them. I am not exaggerating. There are like seven in my living room right now because my two-year-old loves them and will keep them forever. And he has one from, it might have been my birthday last spring, that he's just been dragging around the house. And if you give him a new Mylar balloon, he will not accept it. He will go back to the one from last spring, which is completely deflated. But I have a thing for Mylar balloons.
I really liked the reference because this recently came up and I was celebrating a friend before her wedding and we had two kinds of balloons, and she revealed at the little get together we were having that she doesn't like regular balloons because she feels like they're always on the verge of popping, but Mylar balloons are okay for some reason. So we were like, okay, in the future, no regular balloons, but only Mylar balloons.
I don't like any balloon that has the threat of floating away.
Right. Well, it's two very different kinds of loss, right? There's like the sudden, jarring, loud loss of a regular balloon, and then the very slow, graceful loss of the Mylar balloon. So it really is personality dependent. Like, what, you know, how would you choose, you know, how would you choose? But anyway, I will say this, back to the game for a
Let's
second.
Let's hear this transition.
Speaking of bursting, speaking of popping someone's balloon, it was just an interesting dichotomy, right? To watch Tyler Huntley and then to watch an offense that was piloted with Justin Fields for two quarters. And wasn't the entire deal with Nagy supposed to be that, like, you know, there was this element of whatever he was going to be able to do that wasn't, he couldn't do it with Mitch Trubisky. And, you know, there was all this creativity that was being kind of backed up like a dam. And we saw so many cool design plays for Tyler Huntley in the first half, like whether it was the rollout and the throwback or some of the empty set stuff where he was just like running sweeps and stuff like that. Like, where is that with the Bears? Like, where is any of that creativity for Justin Fields? And how is he not being schemed in the same way to help him the way that, you know, theoretically Greg Roman can scheme for Tyler Huntley to help him?
I wonder if he'd, I wonder if he'd argue that it's like, oh, we don't want to do the gimmicky stuff. We want to build the foundation on like the vanilla stuff that defines this offense. That's my guess. That might not be his reasoning, but maybe it's in the realm of possibility that it is.
But I think you do what the quarterback does well immediately to build confidence and, you know, have kind of a workable base for the offseason right away, right? You don't want to put them out there and have them feeling like they're failing at everything. And then you add in the other stuff as you go, which is exactly what the Ravens have done with Lamar Jackson. Not saying Jackson and Fields are the same exact player, but if you have a player that needs to develop into a well-rounded NFL quarterback, which is very common for players coming out into the NFL today, you start with the things they do well, and then you add things as they go on. But it's been a frustrating season overall for the Bears, and reportedly there were fire Nagy chants as the team left the field. So a lot up in the air for the future of the Bears.
This reminds me of Jenny's point where when I was in second grade, right, there was this mandate that everybody had to learn math at the same speed. And so we learned something called touch points, and every number had touch points on it. And so instead of adding, you would touch the touch points together. And then by touching those touch points, you would come up with the correct answer, right? So the number one had one touch point on the top of the number one. And then number two had one at the edge, the top edge, and then the bottom edge. So if you wanted to do 1 + 2, you did 1, 2, 3. You touched the three numbers, and then you came out with it, right? Now, is that an absurd way to learn math? Yes. And do I still touch things in the air when I'm adding simple numbers together? Yes. But did I learn math, like, quickly? Yeah. So, like, you know, Justin Fields, like, yeah, you might be doing some weird stuff for a while into your 30s, but there should be a quicker way to help you. There should be a quicker way to help you do more than you're doing.
Okay, interesting, Connor.
That story has probably produced a lot more questions than answers.
I was going to say, I've never heard of this.
More on touch points and the midweek podcast.
Maybe that'll be our Wednesday podcast, various math techniques. I have to say, when I was in middle school, I had this way of factoring quadratics that I had learned from a teacher somewhere else, but not the current teacher that I had. It was called the rainbow method, where you would like rainbow the, you know, I don't know. I can explain it on our Wednesday podcast. So I ended up having to teach the whole class the rainbow method for factoring quadratics because I was the only one who knew the rainbow method. So maybe we should devote a whole show to mathematic techniques. I'm ready. I've already got my thing.
It seems like just a lazy teacher who wanted a little bit of time off.
Maybe so.
Texans, Titans.
All right, so on paper, this was the upset of the day. This was the upset of the day. I'm not going to get that down on the Titans at this point. They shouldn't be losing to the Texans, but they kind of lost this game to the Texans in the same way that the Titans knocked off, like, the Rams or the Saints the last 2 weeks, where it was just it was a bunch of weird turnovers in the first half and just fell behind and just never climbed back into it. I mean, they lost a game. The Texans had 3.1 yards per play in this game and went 6 for 17 on third down. But that, you know, when you turn it over five times, that's how you lose to the Texans. And the final was 22-13.
I loved, I was going to tweet this, but then I remember that there's no point in tweeting anything. But that Tyrod Taylor is awesome. Like, I love Tyrod Taylor. I love watching Tyrod Taylor play. And I think that as dumb as this is going to sound coming out of my mouth, which I should preface most things that I say by saying that. But like, if you put like a Tyrod Taylor when he's on, and then you give him like a somewhat like mobile catching back out of the backfield like David Johnson, and I'm not saying he lit the world on fire or anything today, but like, if you give him some of these little things, like, I think there is a recipe for your team to lose regardless of how good you are, right? Like, and I'm not saying that like Tyrod Taylor can beat like the whatever, you know, the 1995 Green Bay Packers by himself or something like that, but I'm just saying like, he's good enough with those little ingredients at his fingertips to like chip away at an upset like this. He's a very good quarterback, and underrated quarterback is what I'm trying to say.
Well, he's a guy, you get a lead. I mean, that's every quarterback wants to get a lead, but he especially is a guy who he gets a lead, and then he can do a lot of expansive stuff in the run game, and he doesn't turn the ball over. And that's a good formula. You're not going to get many leads with this Texans roster.
If there's one criticism to have about the Titans, not just this season, but maybe over the last couple, is that they sometimes have a tendency to play down to their opponents. I mean, it's an easy thing to say because they lost to the Jets and the Texans this year, but it does seem to be something that recurs with them. And I don't really know how you fix that. I liked your tweet, Connor. You did tweet about this, where it's like, oh, you know, you lose to the really bad teams, so you lull the really good teams into thinking that you're not so good, and then you catch them off guard. You know, obviously that's not what they're trying to do, but it is kind of interesting, right, that they're able to beat the top teams in the league. We had them near the top of the power rankings last week because they looked like the most consistent team in the AFC at that point, and then they drop one of these games. I mean, it was also a weird game. Like, the weather conditions were terrible. It was like pouring rain. Mike Vrabel looked like a drowned rat. I mean, you know, it was just not the best circumstances for anybody, really. But I mean, he was totally soaked. I have to mention this. This is not really what you consider analysis, but like, he was drenched.
I wonder if that's part of the tough guy aesthetic, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, I was wondering, like, did he have guys running over, like, dumping extra water on him to really, like, to really get it emphasized here?
And it's weird, though, because everything in a coach's wardrobe, like, and I imagine that they dress like this when they're not coaching as well, like, everything in their wardrobe is moisture and is moisture wicking. Like, have you ever seen a coach not wearing moisture wicking fabric? Like, they're constantly wearing it. And yet Mike Vrabel looked like he was at the bottom of a lake for the entire contest. That's an astute observation, Jenny.
Yeah. You know, it just seemed like something worth noting.
Colts Bills.
All right. So the Colts go over to Western New York and win this one 41-15. People just don't realize that the Colts are actually a really good team, and they're 6-5 now, and they're going to be in the playoff conversation. And if they hadn't sort of just given it away too many times early in the year with all these red zone gaffes, this is a team that would be winning their division, and we'd be putting them in the same conversation as these other top AFC teams. But I don't know, they're really good, and Jonathan Taylor is really good, and he was basically impossible to tackle in this game for the most part, and he scored 5 touchdowns, which is a lot of touchdowns, and scoring touchdowns is a skill, as we now know.
Yeah, big beef game here for the Colts. Huge performance, but Taylor, like, this is incredible, right? The Bills came into this game as the best pass defense in the NFL and the third best rushing defense in the NFL, and Taylor has Quentin Nelson not for the entirety of this game. I think he's had Quentin Nelson for 100% of the snaps in a game only 5 times this year. Only one of their offensive linemen is considered by, well, Pro Football Focus here is what we're going to use because they grade offensive linemen, but they've won top 10 offensive linemen by Pro Football Focus standards, and he's just dragging people all over the field, and he's winning in the pass game, he's winning in the run game, and it was just an incredible performance, so much so that I do think his teammates said that he deserves to be in the MVP conversation, and I would back them on that. He's having a 2006-esque LaDainian Tomlinson-type season where he's not going to score 30 touchdowns, but I think he's going to score like 19 or 20. And, you know, he's basically keeping this team alive, almost offense alive, almost single-handedly.
Yeah, I mean, Derrick Henry had a big lead in the rushing standings until he got injured. Taylor finally passes him now, you know, because Henry's been out, obviously, with the injury. But I do think Taylor and the run game for the Colts have just been gaining steam as the season goes on. And it was a notable contrast to the Bills because their biggest hole right now is the fact that they don't have a reliable run game. And so the offense is not multidimensional. And Connor, you have been saying this all offseason. Like, what's the counterpunch? What additional element are they adding to build on the offense's success from last year? And the lack of a run game was really glaring in a game like this, because for the Colts, as you said, it's totally keeping them alive and it ensures that too much isn't on the quarterback. Now, in the Bills' case, yes, you do want a lot on Josh Allen's plate, but if you don't have a multidimensional offense, it's just not going to work. And I think that's the games when you've seen their offense sputter, it's because of the run game. They don't have that second dimension to their offense. Also, Connor, I was thinking about this. You know how your Oracle was a little bit off? There was food poisoning, but it was a different AFC South team. And then there was a meat, but maybe it was a different meat, and maybe chicken was the meat. And so, like, the game in which the Colts beat the Bills in a city where there's buffalo chicken wings, right? Maybe chicken is really what's representative of that this team.
Just anything to make me look less wrong, I really, yeah. I think yeah. is good.
So chicken, chicken, chicken.
Chicken, you know. Chicken, chicken, beef, beef,
yeah.
beef.
Yeah. We could switch the little shtick here.
Unless the beef is the bison, the buffalo, and that Ooh. Was, you know.
Okay.
I don't know. You know.
Yeah, maybe. Lots of potential options here, but I think what we know now is that the Oracle was mostly right. Like, you're in the ballpark, you're still sharpening your skills to be precise, but the general vibes or the big picture takeaways are there.
I just want to say this is, and I was not on the Weak Side podcast, but I feel like the Oracle is slowly transforming into more of like a, who's that guy, John Edward, the guy, the
yes,
ghost talker
that's
guy.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah,
it's taking on a lot more of that type of vibe at this point.
Yeah, I'm not going for like a Vegas Sharp thing. I'm going for like a, I'm going for like a 1-800. What is it like? What's the
The Psychic Friends Network?
Yes,
is that what you're
yes,
going for?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 1-800 like Psychic Friends, where it's like, I'm vaguely going to put you down in the right direction, and then the rest is up to you. And so maybe the true prediction is everything we all learned along the way. Like, that's what I'm going to do here. You know, that's kind of the goal.
I just want to throw in my Bills concern real quick before we move on. It's that we've seen them be steamrolled by Jonathan Taylor and by Derrick Henry at this point, and they haven't seen a whole lot of good offenses other than those two. Well, they played the Chiefs, and the Chiefs, you know, that game was a little bit different as far as flow goes. But right now they're having issues with power run games. They are a half game behind the Patriots. Those teams will match up twice in December. And the Patriots right now are winning with an offense that is, yes, built around Mac Jones, but also relying heavily on that power run game with Damian Harris and Ramondre Stevenson. So,
and the use of a fullback.
Yep.
And not only that, but look at what they have in between there. And I'm not saying that the Saints, you know, have a power running game, but they have Alvin Kamara, right? So you're getting Alvin Kamara, you're getting the Patriots, you're getting the Buccaneers, who basically won a Super Bowl by running up the middle throughout the entirety of the playoffs and seem to like to convert to that, just like the Patriots did in November, right? Where you just become that power running team. And then you get Christian McCaffrey and then the Patriots again before finishing the season with Atlanta and the Jets. So this could get a lot worse before it gets better.
Washington Panthers.
All right, this was the game where every player on both teams at some point had been released or traded from the Carolina Panthers or fired by the Carolina Panthers. Everyone was a former Panther in some way in this game, or maybe a future former Panther, if you want to say it that way.
There you go, Gary.
So this this was football team 27, Panthers 21, and look, we were all, you know, zeroing in on Cam Newton and his first start in his return to Carolina. He played the entire game. There's no rotation with him and PJ Walker as some people might have expected. And I think Cam was pretty much as expected here. The offense looked like what you thought it would look like. He was fine as a passer. It was a fairly limited passing game, but he's been there for like 10 days, so I'm not sure what else to expect. But this one was about the taxpayer, Taylor Heinicke, and just the power of a guy who, you know, this is not, it's not a consistent offense. It's a little bit uneven, but he just made a handful of like second reaction plays at huge moments. And that ends up being the difference in a game like this where I think the Panthers are better than Washington. I think they beat them like 7 out of 10 times if they played on a neutral field. And Washington goes down there and steals a win in what's a close playoff race for the wild card spots in the NFC.
Yeah, oddly, you know, not oddly, right? We should have expected this coming. The NFC East was never, you know, I don't think anyone was ever necessarily going to run away with this. And even though Dallas is far out ahead, there's like that slog for that second place finish. And one of those teams could very well kind of end up in the seventh seed. And so, yeah, I don't know. It was a good performance. And Taylor Heinicke is, you know, there was some grumbling about Ryan Fitzpatrick being formally out for the season. But at this point, like, I don't know if Ryan Fitzpatrick is a market improvement over Taylor Heinicke at this point, right? And like, I know that Taylor Heinicke is not the quarterback of the future in Washington, and that's going to be a big focus of their offseason, obviously. But I think you have to be somewhat happy about what you've gotten out of him so far. Like, I think he's almost been like a Ryan Fitzpatrick plus type of presence anyway.
Yeah. Last season, they have a close playoff loss to the Bucks with Heinicke in there. This year, you feel at least like you're going in the right direction. You sort of avoid that kind of demoralizing season where it feels like the team's going nowhere. I think that is valuable, that even if Heinicke isn't your long-term answer in Washington, that you can at least end this season with some good vibes and potentially good momentum about how the team is built or whatever the case may be, just a better carryover into next season.
Saints, Eagles.
So here come the Eagles. After all that, they win this one 40-29 over the Saints. And just two quick notes on what Nick Sirianni and his staff are doing here. Jalen Hurts, we know what he can do with his legs. They ran for 242 in this game. That's, you know, they got a lead and they pretty much dominated on the ground. But, you know, he's also, the things he's building in the passing game here are, it's getting Hurts working late into the down. It's you at some point probably want to build in more traditional pocket play into this offense, but I don't think it's completely necessary at this point. I don't think it's where Hurts has to be in his development. And right now what they're doing works. It very clearly works at this point.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we were talking about earlier in the conversation about Fields, right? Is you start with the things that they do well and you add in different things to complement that. And we've seen that as the season has gone on with Hurts. I think it's been really encouraging. He has 3 rushing touchdowns in this game, the first quarterback to do that in franchise history. I mean, let's be honest here. If Deshaun Watson had been interested at all in going to Philadelphia, I think they would have been really publicly in the mix for him. I don't think they thought that Hurts would play this well this season. And so I think it's great for Hurts that he's had this kind of season, because I think he's surprising even the people at the top of the organization.
Yeah, this was a gutsy season for him. And, you know, yes, the Devonta Smith thing would lead you to believe that they wanted him to be at least somewhat stable and stocked. But this was essentially sort of a simultaneous teardown rebuild, right? And like coaches that we've talked about who've gone through this, unless you're a franchise quarterback, how many of these guys do you actually see come out the other side? And Hurts, I think, has a really good chance of coming out the other side. Like, if you're Philadelphia, you have 3 first-round picks next year going into a draft where Baker doesn't seem to be necessarily a quarterback that you would take at the top of the draft or invest all of your money to move up for. If you're out on Watson, you know, then I think that this is a perfect scenario for them. I think you can build around him. And Sirianni, to his credit, has also been, has established himself as a guy who seems somewhat interested in developing Hurts. So I think it's a good deal for Philadelphia all around.
Jonathan Gannon, too, their defensive coordinator, he comes under a lot of fire because they are one of the least blitz-heavy teams in the NFL, and he dialed it up in this game. They clearly caught the Saints off guard in the first half here with a lot of blitzing on third downs, and this was a the score was, it was 40-29, and it was probably not that close. I mean, this was a really comfortable Eagles win here against the Saints team that's probably pretty good in their own right.
Super random, by the way, that like the Eagles like have put up like a few random like offensive explosions this year. You know what I mean? Like it's not a team that I don't know. It's not a team that we thought was going to do a whole lot, and here they are.
They save it for the NFC South. Laid 32 on the Falcons. Laid 44 on the Lions, who are an honorary NFC South team.
Yeah. The Eagles are like, you know, their slogan this year would be like, the Eagles. All right. You know,
better than expected.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Cardinals, Seahawks.
All right. Colt McCoy goes into Seattle for a second straight year in a spot start and leads his team to a win. This one, he didn't do a whole lot of lifting last year when the Giants went up there and beat the Seahawks. That was a very run heavy game plan. This one was a little more, I mean, it looked kind of like a Kyler Murray game plan that they rolled out there. I'm sure it wasn't exactly the same, but there were a couple design runs for him. I mean, they kind of just did what they do in this one, and the Seahawks, boy, just on both sides of the ball, they're just not terribly competitive at this point.
After the game, Pete Carroll walked off the podium after just a few questions from reporters and said, "I'm done." Then he reemerged a few minutes later and said, "Sorry, I'm just not good at this." By at this, he means losing. And then did take questions after and said that he respected that the media had a job to do and that he was here to answer them. But interesting, like nothing kind of feels like it's working. There is the specter of Russell Wilson wanting to exit last year hanging over all of this. And like, at what point, if you're Pete or if you're John Schneider, do you look at a game like this and just be like, you know, let's take the three first round picks and the starters and the mid round guys, and let's just, you know, let's move on. Let's just figure out a different way to do this.
Yeah, I think the roster has really eroded over time as a result of some draft misses. And they're just so far from the identity that they had when they were a dominant team. This season is obviously the setting up to be the worst one under Pete Carroll. And it's just like, it doesn't in any facet look like the teams that he's coached in Seattle. I think the one moment where that really stood out to me was when the Seahawks pulled within 3 points and all they had to do was get the Cardinals off the field for a chance to win the game. And they just couldn't get them off the field. And then the Cardinals, there's a penalty in the end zone. The Cardinals score a touchdown and the game is over. And it was just one of those situations where you just need the defense to make a stop. And the defense just couldn't make a stop. Colt McCoy, backup quarterback, keeps the Cardinals offense alive. And it was just, it just felt like a bizarro Seahawks team.
Yeah, that was a 10 play, 4 minute, 45 second drive down at the late fourth quarter. And look, they couldn't get him off the field. They finally got into a third and goal from the 4 yard line, and it looked like, you know, if they could have held him to a field goal, it's still a one possession game. And you know, you end up with a matchup where Jamal Adams is on Zach Ertz, and that's not going to work for the Seahawks. Even though Ertz has probably lost half a step from his prime, it just was a huge mismatch. He ended up giving up the penalty. Put the Cardinals on the one, they punch it in on the next play, et cetera, et cetera. And that was it. But yeah, the Cardinals offense was out there for more than 40 minutes. It was a long day for the Seahawks defense. And it's an offense that they scored one touchdown since Russell Wilson came back. They're now 2-5 with Russ in the lineup. He had some issues against the Cardinals, against what Vance Joseph threw at him last year, so maybe it just happens to be two tough matchups for Russell Wilson here since he returned, but he looked bad in this game. He made two second reaction throws that were sort of classic Russell Wilson type of plays, but that was about it. He never looked comfortable in the pocket. He misfired on a couple red zone throws. It was just not a very good performance. And again, like he has to play at near MVP level for this team to get back into it at this point. And I just don't know how they do it. They're 3-7 and they're 1-5 in the conference. So they're going to lose like every tiebreaker. They have to get to like 10 wins. And I don't see how they possibly get there.
Yeah, well, they're not going to, right? There's one team in NFL history, I think, that has gone from 3-7 to the playoffs. So I think they have like literally like a 1% chance of doing this. And so it's going to be interesting, right? What do you do? Do you recommit to Russell Wilson? Do you tear everything down? I think it's going to be fascinating. My only other observation from this game is that I can't believe how much faster James Conner looks with the Cardinals and like just bigger. I don't know why. I think it's the number too. The numbers changes do things. Did you notice that? Like, he's number six, and he just looks faster and bigger, and both of the Derrick Henry backups in Tennessee have the single-digit numbers and just look larger for some reason because of it? I don't know. I think there's something there.
You know? Single-digit numbers are like, widening. It definitely makes you look bigger.
Yes. Yeah. So good for him. That was a good choice for him. But also, like, you know, leading the league in touchdowns.
Yes,
is a good
that's
thing for
also
him too. Yeah,
all the touchdowns he scores. That's a good idea too.
Yeah.
Bengals Raiders.
We have arrived at the lightning-ish round, and we will do Bengals fans a favor here by putting them back in the lightning-ish round, where they seemed very comfortable earlier in the year until we sort of elevated them and then things went sour. But they break a two-game losing streak. They come out of the bye here and get a real nice win in Vegas. And I don't know, this just looked more like the team we saw early in the season, where, you know, yes, it's Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase flash, but it's a defense that doesn't miss tackles, and it's a run game that can kind of do its thing for stretches of the game, and that's what you saw from Joe Mixon in this one.
Yeah, Gary, I think a part of the game when we saw why the Bengals are different this year was late in the fourth quarter, the Raiders had pulled within 3 points, and the Bengals are on the goal line. They have third down. If they score a field goal, then the Raiders are still within one possession. But if they score the touchdown, then they have a two-possession lead. And Joe Burrow just floated that perfect pass to Ja'Marr Chase in the corner of the end zone, who got separation from the defensive back. And it was just like all things in one, why this team is a little bit different, right? They're capable of making big plays like that. The quarterback to his top receiver, they have this fantastic chemistry this season. And then from there, they blew open the game even further. But that was the kind of decisive play you need to be really good in the NFL. And Burrow and Chase just pulled it off kind of seamlessly.
Lions Browns.
So the Browns won this game. According to the final score, it was, what, 13-10? But I don't know. Everyone's just super bummed, and Baker Mayfield is not talking to the media after the game, and it was not a good performance by their offense. But look, it was the Lions. It was Tim Boyle. But it's a win. This is a team that needed to win a game and sort of get going again.
Yeah, I don't know if this is necessarily I don't know if this is necessarily what they had in mind. I mean, certainly there were elements of the run game that were clicking. I mean, when you had Chubb back, you know, you had some of those bigger sort of second level carries where he was, you know, getting into the point where he could break tackles against safeties and stuff, which is what he's really good at. Some fun trickery with Jarvis Landry, but also I think Landry had a pretty decent game. But other than that, I mean, this is still a team that's very much stuck in neutral, and there's some painful elements to this offense. Baker is still floating a lot, like he was, you know, a couple seasons ago, and I don't know what you make of this. I mean, you know, I thought that the Lions were going to win this game basically since the outset of the week. I mean, I thought this was a classic trap game for Cleveland where things were going bad, and then you would also be Dan Campbell's first win, and this team is just going to grind you down until the end of the fourth quarter. But, you know, kudos to them. I mean, they just sneak away with a game that they're probably going to lose on any other occasion. But, yeah, I mean, the formula isn't exactly clicking here, and Baker missed some throws. I mean, he had some pretty serious, you know, sailing problems today.
I think what makes it hard for the Browns to get the full evaluation they need to make a decision on Mayfield's future with the organization is that he's so banged up this season. He had three different injuries in this game, the shoulder, the knee, and a foot injury. So he's not playing at full strength. It's not clear how far from full strength he is. It's not clear how that's affecting his performance. Did that feed into some of his post-game frustrations? I don't know the answer to those questions, but he's clearly ailing, and he's continuing to play because the team still has everything in front of it. But are you actually going to be able to realize your goals this season when your quarterback has this many injuries?
It was a weird game not to sit Baker. And I know that you needed this game, right? And I know that, you know, people would have said, oh, well, what would you have done if, you know, Case Keenum couldn't? But isn't a healthy Case Keenum like a better option for like right now? Just like right now, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I agree, Connor. I think that's a discussion to be had, is like, this would have been the ideal week to sit Baker and let him get a little bit healthier. And if he continues to muddle through these injuries, they just build up over time.
49ers, Jaguars.
All right, so a quick appreciation for the 49ers and their opening drives. Monday night against the Rams, they get the interception on the deep ball to Odell, and then they go on an 11-minute drive. They took the opening drive in this game, 20 plays, 87 yards, 13 minutes 5 seconds, which is just absurd. They took basically the entire first quarter off the clock here, which, yes, they settled for a Robbie Gould field goal from 20 yards, but it made this game so much shorter. Like, I feel like Trey Lance was out there in victory formation at, like, I don't know, like 3:05 today, and like we just all got to get out of here and not have to really think too much about the 30-10 win over the Jaguars.
That is the one beautiful thing that we, you know, outside zone teams have taken a big hit this season. Like, you could argue that, yes, the Packers are 8-3, but have not been sort of a beautiful offense. The Titans have struggled, sans Derrick Henry, to look more efficient. The Falcons have not been as good as we thought they were. And the 49ers are obviously a disappointing team this year. But that is the one thing that you can do almost without fail, right, is pick up like 3.2 yards per carry, because you're diversifying the run game so much, where you're basically running the same two or three looks, but on this play, this guy pulls, and on this play, this guy pulls, and on this play, the tight end's over here or over here. And especially for a coach like Urban Meyer, it's just going to be tough. I mean, there's no outside zone in college. I mean, Arizona, I think the University of Arizona is like the first team that's actually kind of actively running like a collegiate style outside zone. So this is something he's probably not seen a whole great deal of, probably something he's not entirely used to. And, San Francisco can take advantage of it. And kudos to everybody who tried to guess on their fantasy football teams who was going to be their starting running back this year, and then ended up just being Deebo Samuel. You should have just taken Deebo Samuel.
I was going to say, Deebo Samuel has really been fun to watch this season. And even though the 49ers have struggled, they use him in so many different creative ways. And in the games when they're winning, that becomes even more fun to watch. So today was another great example of that.
Tough to say this against the Jaguars, right? You don't know if it's a repetitive performance, and it's always easy to have, not easy, but, you know, more likely to have one of your better games against the Jaguars. But big Brandon Ayuk breakout game here. And you're wondering if, you know, all season, right, part of the 49ers offense is you're running versions of the same play, like we said before, but the same thing goes for the receivers, where you're running repetitive routes and you're trying to catch the defense in different looks and you're trying to catch the defense sleeping. If all of a sudden everything starts shifting towards Deebo Samuel, do you finally see a little bit of a Brandon Ayuk breakout? And I think that might be potential for further good games down the road.
Dolphins, Jets.
All right, and we will wrap this one up with the Dolphins' 24-17 victory over the Jets in East Rutherford. You had Joe Flacco. You had, I don't know, other players in this game. I will say, I'm not going to argue that this game was good or watchable or redeemable in any way, but there was a series in the third quarter where you actually got two like long touchdown passes in a row, which these are two teams that don't really specialize in that. Zach Wilson maybe a little bit, but you know, you weren't expecting like a Flacco like 60-yard connection to Elijah Moore, and certainly from what we've seen from Tua Tagovailoa, he has not done much downfield throwing, and I've been critical of Tua. That was a really good play. That was a play where there was pressure, and instead of drifting back in the pocket or sort of trying to very slowly escape out the side of the pocket and doing something disastrous, he actually stepped up through the pocket and then found a wide open guy downfield. And maybe that's a good lesson for him and something we'll see more from him down the stretch here as he sort of tries to play his way into the, I don't know, the 2022 job at this point. But that's it. I feel like I broke this game down more than anyone really should.
Maybe there's something for Tua to build on. As for the Jets, though, I'm not really sure that there's anything to build on. Zach Wilson still out of the lineup. They want to wait till he's, I think Robert Saleh said, at full health and full confidence. And really, that was the whole point of the 2021 season, right, was to try to develop your number two overall pick. So a game like this where you're starting Joe Flacco, your third quarterback of the season, like, it's just hard to take much of this game to build on down the road.
This game, though, is home to my favorite line from a color commentator this year, when it was just like a sleepy sort of moment in the third quarter, and all of a sudden the color commentator just says, "Yeah, you know, not a lot of real wow plays, not a lot of flashy plays from Joe Flacco so far." And it was just like, what were you expecting going in there? Like, was there a history of flashy Joe Flacco plays that, like, you know, we just all sort of missed before this game? But so if nothing else, the game was entirely redeemable for me just cackling by myself watching that.
I would suggest the NFL, these teams play again later this season, and it would require some schedule shuffling, but I'd be all for, so like the Patriots and Bills will match up twice, and those will be like marquee matchups. I would take the Jets-Dolphins games, and instead of playing a full 60-minute game, I would have them play at halftime, like a mini game, kind of like when they send the Pee Wee teams out.
Yes.
And just, you know, each team gets one series. And if they both score, hey, it's a tie. And like, that's it. But, you know, I think that might be a better presentation of this. Of this subsequent matchup between these two teams.
It's like the softball game in Wet Hot American Summer where they all decide that it just feels kind of trite.
The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Frentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Sheldon Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Thanks, as always, to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom, who gives us the best notes in the business. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.